What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This spring, 538 people were incarcerated in the Prince George's County Jail in Maryland. Almost 95% of them were in jail awaiting trial, according to the County Department of Corrections. In other words, they weren't serving time. They were in jail biding their time before trial because many simply could not make bail. And then the COVID pandemic hit. Well, Katie Chambly-Ryan joins us now. And Katie, the first case of COVID in the Prince George's County Jail was reported on March 30th, 2020. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, Your Honor. There was, I apologize. I was just in court. I called you Your Honor.
I feel honored, but it's okay.
Well, I hope you do. It becomes instinctive. The first case in the jail, a woman who is actually now serving a short sentence on theft charges became sick, repeatedly tried to get medical attention and was unable to get it. Finally, she was tested for COVID and tested positive and then placed in isolation. She has hypertension, which makes people higher risk for COVID. And from there, the virus continued to spread in the jail. And yet the jail was not treating people, was not screening people, was not testing people. By the end of April, of the tests they'd done, 90% had come back positive. They only tested, fewer than 30 people. They also had, I believe at that point, there were 27 cases in staff. And those were not from the jail's test. A lot of those were from the staff's own reports of their testing. Yeah. So it spread rapidly.
So I should let people know that you are a senior attorney and coordinator of the Prosecutor Project at Civil Rights Corps, a criminal justice nonprofit. And the reason why you instinctively said Your Honor is because obviously you're an attorney and you are representing incarcerated people in the Prince George's County Jail because they have sued the jail. They've sued the Department of Corrections for its handling of the COVID pandemic. And we're going to talk about that case in a lot of detail today, Katie. But I'm looking at court documents here, including the complaint that you filed with descriptions from the incarcerated people here. Tell us about some of the conditions that they describe in the jail, say, when they did come down with COVID, and where were they sent in the jail if they tested positive?
Well, when we brought the suit, the conditions were deplorable in the jail. There was no access to even basic prevention methods like soap. People had to pay for bars of soap. Some people couldn't.
Katie, you still there? We're going to try and get her back on the line. I'm going to pull up, while we do that, I am actually going to pull up some of the declarations from the members of the incarcerated people who had filed this lawsuit in federal court against the Prince George's County Jail. For example, one of the people say that they were in a cell that was 8 feet by 8 feet. Their bunks were only 4 feet apart. They hadn't seen any staff or detainees clean any parts of the unit that they were housed in. The only cleaning they saw was inmates sweeping the floors. And this is, of course, as a pandemic is going on. There were isolation cells in there as well. And Katie, I think we've got you back now. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So tell us about, I was mentioning the isolation cells that at least some of the people inside the jail were sent to when they tested positive for COVID. What were those isolation cells like?
Yeah. So when people tested positive for COVID, they were sent into isolation cells that often were not cleaned in between prisoners. And so repeatedly, person after person described them with incredible consistency as being covered with feces, mucus, and blood. There was sometimes urine on the floor. Sometimes there was urine on the mattress where they were asked to sleep. The people in the isolation cells were not given access to showers. Some went as long as 14 days without showers. And then once they tested positive, they were in isolation when they were suspected positive. When they tested positive, they were moved to a quarantine cell that they shared with other people who were positive, but jail staff were terrified to go there. So the trash built up, no one refilled the water. There was vomit and tissues and mucus in the trash can that was overflowing with tissues. And again, people couldn't shower and weren't given change of clothes. One prisoner described how some people, because they didn't even have clean underwear, you know, had to stop wearing it because they just didn't have anything comfortable to wear. They didn't have access to toothbrushes, no one to call. And in those conditions, it is an incredibly harsh set of solitary confinement conditions. There is nothing to do. There is no radio. There is no music. There is no TV. You can't call your loved ones. You also can't call your lawyer. And access to criminal defense counsel has been a huge problem in the pandemic. But even outside of the isolation cells, in the general population cells, the jail's strategy for dealing with this pandemic, once it developed one at all, has largely been to lock people down in their cells. Even though the Centers for Disease Control doesn't recommend that, they recommend social distancing measures, reducing the population of the jail. Instead, the jail's population is growing. At the end of May, it was 519. As of this Monday, it was 635. And people have been locked down in their cells for 23 hours per day with absolutely nothing to do.
So I'm reading a section of the declaration from one of the inmates there who says that this 23-hour lockdown per day began on April 6th. In the cell that this person's in, he says there's bad ventilation. It makes it harder for him to breathe. His coughing is at that time when he filed this declaration, coughing was continuing. He's coughing up mucus. His chest hurt. Woke up with a bloody nose at least one morning. So those usually would be symptoms that would deserve at least some kind of medical care. But of course, especially in this pandemic, those symptoms would be extremely alarming. Are inmates able to get timely medical care even in the midst of this 23-hour day lockdown?
No. And that was one of the most pervasive problems in this jail. And it continues to this day. Every single day, our team gets calls from people in the jail about delays in medical care. I think we've submitted declarations in this case from over 40 detainees, and we've talked to well over 100. No one has reported getting timely care. I think that what you see here is something that's happening across the country. My guess is that this jail did not have a good process for providing timely care in normal times, that there was already a problem. What COVID has done, as it's done in so many areas of our society, is it intensified that problem.
Right.
It made its consequences more dire and more terrifying and brought it to the fore. Yes.
Yeah, so that's exactly why we wanted to actually spend an hour looking into this, because it's not that what's happening in the Prince George's County jail in Maryland is exceptional. it's not necessarily exceptional that makes it something that's deserving of a lot more attention. So let me, I mean, I'm going to spend a lot of time going through these details, Katie, because they're important. Some of the inmates allege that in order to get into the medical unit there at the jail, they might have been able to, but they had to pay $4 for a form to request medical care.
Yes. So the way that people normally get medical care at the Prince George's County Jail is to use something called the sick call process. And a lot of jails have something like this. Sick call costs money. You have to pay $4 for it. The only way you could get out of that is if somebody on the jail staff deems what's happening to you urgent or an emergency. I don't know what criteria that would involve, but you know, it's never been made clear to us. But so a lot of people that we spoke to at the time we filed the lawsuit said they had symptoms of COVID, but they didn't have $4. The jail technically has a process for people who are indigent, who can't afford the $4. But I believe the standard for that is that you have to have not had more than something like 99 cents in your account for at least a month. So if you had $2, you still couldn't afford sick call, but you're not poor enough to be considered indigent, you still couldn't pay for medical care. My understanding is that the jail is no longer charging people. That's a good thing. But people still can't access care. They are still being delayed. And unfortunately, you know, one of the most harrowing things about doing this case for me and for everyone on our team is getting calls every day from the jail for someone who has horrible conditions. A lot of times they appear to be people with long-term symptoms of COVID. So for example, I've repeatedly gotten calls from a man who had COVID in April and since then has been profusely bleeding from his nose and rectum. It has not stopped. Another one has been unable to breathe and the jail is not giving them care because they already had COVID. They're not treating their symptoms anymore. They've gone through their 14 days and it's done.
Right. And I was in some of the court documents, the Department of Corrections says that by virtue of many of the inmates not requesting sick care, because as you were saying, they couldn't afford the $4 to begin with, but by not requesting sick care, they didn't prove that they needed medical care. And so that their rights weren't violated, as you allege in the lawsuit. So we're going to talk more about how the Department of Corrections in Maryland has responded to this lawsuit when we come back. We are going inside the Prince George's County Jail in Maryland and talking about COVID and the criminal justice system. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are going inside the Prince George's County, Maryland jail to get a glimpse as to what COVID is revealing about the criminal justice system in terms of what has been happening and alleged to be happening within the walls of one correctional facility in Maryland. I'm joined today by Katie Chambly-Ryan. She's a senior attorney and coordinator of the Prosecutor Project at the Civil Rights Corps, a criminal justice nonprofit. She's representing several incarcerated people in the Prince George's County Jail who have brought a federal lawsuit against the Department of Corrections in Maryland for the conditions they say they endured inside the jail. Now, the Department of Corrections in Maryland, we reached out to them to see if they could provide someone for this hour. They said they could not because of this ongoing lawsuit. But Katie, they did send us an extended statement responding to some of the allegations in the suit. I mean, basically, you allege that the people's rights had been violated. And I just want to read a little bit of this statement here. It says, the claims being made against the facility are false and entirely meritless. Since the start of the pandemic, the positivity rate in the facility has remained lower than that of the county. And then they reference some numbers from testing that was done in May. And then they go on to say that that the low positivity rate is a result of numerous actions taken by the Prince George's Department of Corrections beginning in early February. So basically they say that there's no problem right now.
Well, I would respond to that in several ways. First, I would just note that an independent inspection was done of the jail and found that nurses did not know the symptoms of COVID. This was in the beginning of May. That staff did not know the symptoms of COVID, that there were massive delays in the provision of medical care. And so to suggest that there was never any problem is completely contrary to the evidence, including the evidence that the jail itself has submitted. And that's why the court issued an order requiring relief and finding that emergency relief was appropriate in this case when it issued its temporary restraining order. I'd also just note that one reason the jail doesn't have more cases is because...
Katie, are you still there? Looks like we're gonna try and get her back here. Well, while we do that, as I mentioned, we contacted the Maryland Department of Corrections to see if they could provide anyone. They could not. However, we do have on the line now Aisha Braveboy. She is the state's attorney for Prince George's County, and she joins us now. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being with us today. We're going to dig through some more of the details about the lawsuit and the complaint that's been made by now some former inmates in the Prince George's County Jail. But take a step back with me here for a second. You're looking at this from the side of through the eyes of the state's attorney.
Sure.
Is there a fundamental problem here with the operation of these kinds of facilities or the criminal justice system in Maryland that the pandemic is revealing?
I think what it's revealing is when you have when you house people, whether it is in a jail or a nursing home or a hospital or any type of facility. Where you have limited access to the outside, where people are housed together and in close quarters, that, having either an outbreak or several people contracting a virus like coronavirus or any other type of virus, it is more likely. That's just the reality of living in close quarters. So we're talking about this obviously right now in the context of a jail. And certainly from my perspective, I was very concerned about inmates in our jail. I'm also concerned about the safety of the larger community as well. And so what my office believed was the best thing to do at the point where we knew we were facing a pandemic was to release those who we believe could be safely released into the community or at least recommending for release, because we actually don't get to order the release. That is obviously the judge. but we can make recommendations for releasing individuals who we believe don't pose an immediate threat to victims or the larger community. And that's what we did. So our job, obviously, is to keep everyone safe. And we also want to respect everyone's rights, including the rights of those who are in jail. So we were the first county under my leadership to take a proactive step to reduce our inmate population. I just wanted to correct something that you said at the beginning. Actually, when the pandemic started, or at least on March 1st, there were 718 people at the jail. So... we started with that number, and then we were able to reduce the jail population I think at the lowest, it was almost a 40% reduction, and there were around 500, and I think at the lowest point, about 519 people in the jail. However, yeah. During the pandemic, we've actually seen, unfortunately, an increase in homicides, a huge increase in domestic violence and domestic violence related homicides, as well as just like things like strangulation and other very lethal forms of domestic violence that have occurred. And so we have to protect victims. We have to protect our community. So there's a balancing act that state's attorneys like myself have to do.
Mm-hmm.
We've done.
Let me just jump in here for a second. And
sure.
And because I appreciate the clarification on the numbers, just so that listeners know, the numbers that I in terms of the jail population that I was referring to came from the court documents that we could access and the date of this population profile that I was referring to. Just I'm not disputing what you said, Ms. Braveboy. I'm just adding clarification to what I said, was from May. My numbers were from this court document that gave a population profile for May 14th of 2020. So a little bit, reduced numbers.
Yes, we had significantly reduced the jail population at that time. Absolutely.
Yeah. So let me ask you what I wanted to say is you said something there that I actually would like to explore in a little bit more detail. And then hopefully we have Katie Chamley Ryan back and I'll turn to her for her response. But you talked about, recommending people for release. Now, if I understand correctly, isn't there more than one pathway to that? I mean, in one pathway you recommend people for release, but it's up to the Department of Corrections on whether or not to do that. And then the other pathway is to do it before a judge?
So actually there are a few ways. So when an individual in Prince George's County, when an individual is arrested, they initially have an appearance before a commissioner. And the commissioner is a judicial officer, though not a judge. At that point, that individual can either be released on their own recognizance. Commissioner could issue a bond. My office proactively does not recommend cash bonds as condition of release. That's a policy change I made coming into office. So an individual could potentially still get a bond if the commissioner wants to issue a bond, or the person is held over until they can get an appearance before a judge on the next business day. And so if, let's say, they were issued a bond, they can't make the bond, or if they are held without bond by the commissioner, and they then appear before a judge. And at that point, the judge can either agree, let's say, with the commissioner and keep the bond in place, or the judge can release that individual, or the judge can hold them without a bond, or the other thing, which we are really working closely with the jail to help them with, is to release individuals on some other pretrial condition that would not require the payment of funds, but will allow the jail to continue to monitor them, though they wouldn't necessarily be housed in the jail. So there are things like ankle monitors that is of no cost to the defendant. They can also require check-ins with a case manager, which again is cost to the defendant. So we do encourage, where we believe individuals can be safely released, we encourage the courts to release them or set a condition of release that would not require them to pay any money.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's see if we have Katie Chamley Ryan back. Katie, do we have you?
Yes, I'm back.
Good old fashioned telephone. We'll see if that works better than the internet here.
But you've
been hearing what Aisha Braveboy has been saying about the state's attorney's office working to lower the population in the Prince George's County jail. I just want to hear your response to that.
What I could tell you is that in the jail right now, it's simply not accurate to say that the people who are there because of public safety or because I believe I heard Ms. Braveboy cite strangulations and domestic violence. So just for an example, there's a person in the jail right now who's been held since mid-July on misdemeanor, destruction of property, and trespassing. The state's attorney's office opposed him even getting a bond hearing, and he doesn't have a bond hearing set until September. There's another person in the jail who pled guilty to misdemeanor theft in mid-February and is still there, still hasn't had a sentencing hearing. There are people in the jail who could be released on low bond. There's someone there who could be released if he had $200. Another one who's been there for a month could go home if he had $400 to post bond. There are dozens of people in the jail on misdemeanors or nonviolent felonies, and we found 24 that were jailed just on violations of probation. So it's just not accurate to say that it's a public safety issue that is the reason that the population is what it is. And, you know, to the extent there have been efforts to reduce the population, we certainly commend those. It is absolutely the right thing to do and what's uniformly recommended by public health professionals. But we're still seeing people in that jail who are not a threat to public safety, but they are creating a threat to public safety because they're creating a place where the virus can proliferate. The fact that the virus is at a low level now and when they did universal testing does not mean that it will not return in a second wave. It makes sense that it would be low now because they had a massive outbreak. So a large portion of people in the jail had already had it by the time they did testing. It's also not true that the jail's numbers are lower than the community's numbers. In fact, they're talking about a test positivity rate. That's just the rate of positive testing. What it shows is whether you're testing enough. Because, you know, for example, if you have a 90% rate, like what the jail had at the beginning, you're not testing enough people because 90% are coming back positive. So once they tested 100% of people, they had a lower positivity rate than the county. The actual incidence of infection is not lower. And we don't actually know what the incidence of infection is in the community, but we do know that the outbreak in the jail appeared to peak and accelerate before the community's outbreak, which is what you would expect if the conditions there were worse. And we are all very concerned that when a second wave hits this community, which it hasn't done yet, it's going to hit the jail hard, and then the jail will make the community less safe too.
Yeah.
Prince George's County.
I'm going to jump in here, Katie, and I'm sorry about that, but it's just I'm mindful of the time, and I only have Ms. Brave Boy for a couple of more minutes, and I have to let her go at the end of this segment. I just want to give her a chance to respond. It seems like there's two very different views here about what constitutes public safety right now, Ms. Brave Boy.
Well, and I can appreciate the differing views. But the reality is I have a responsibility to protect my community. That is my number one responsibility, and I take that responsibility seriously. When you look at people who have just violated, let's say they violated the terms of their probation, or they violated a domestic violence protective order, we take that very seriously. You know why? Because our victims take that very seriously. And so while we have worked very hard to reduce numbers, what I can't and won't do is put our communities in jeopardy. There have been stories, and we know them. There was one out of Charles County where an individual was arrested on misdemeanor. They call it misdemeanor domestic violence charges. The judge in that case released that individual. A few days later, that individual killed his victim. That is every prosecutor's, every judge's, every community member's, every family member's worst nightmare. Now, we can't protect everyone. Obviously, we wish we could. But to the extent that we can, we are going to. But in doing that, we also look at individuals who are able to be released safely in our community. And the reality is over 1,600 people have come through our jails, whether it's during the initial appearance or after a appearance before a judge, and have been released during this period. That's a lot of people. So yes, we may not agree on every single defendant, but what I will tell you is that we've done our job. We have kept our community safe. We have released those who we believe don't pose a threat to our community. and we will continue to protect everyone's rights, both those who are inside and those who are outside. That is the job of the state's attorney. That is what I'm going to do. And other people will do their jobs and have their perspectives.
Yeah. But you know, Ms. Brevo, I've only got you for about 60 more seconds here. And I heard you say you're going to continue to protect everyone's rights outside the jail and inside the jail. But there is a pending lawsuit in federal court alleging some very serious violations of the rights of people inside that jail.
And those are allegations, as you said, that is being litigated between the county and the plaintiffs. My office, our job is to ensure that those who are in jail should be there because they pose a threat. That's what we are doing. For those who don't pose a threat, we have proactively worked and filed motions with the public defender to release people who were serving time. That's what my office did. We proactively requested that people who were being held on cash bonds have their bonds be converted to unsecured bonds so that they can be released. That's what my office is doing.
So, well, Ms. Brave Boy, I'm so sorry, I've got to let you go. I'm sorry. It's just the clock that's determining my actions right now. But Aisha Brave Boy, state's attorney in Maryland, joining us from Prince George's County, Maryland. Thank you so very much. Katie Chambly Ryan, hang on here for just a second. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are taking a look at what's been going on inside the Prince George's County Jail in Maryland. And we're looking at this one facility because of allegations from incarcerated people inside that jail that their rights were violated due to the terrible conditions inside the jail when the COVID pandemic struck there. I'm joined today by Katie Chambly Ryan. She's senior attorney and coordinator of the Prosecutor Project at the Civil Rights Corps. It's a nonprofit focusing on criminal justice, and she's representing the plaintiffs in this case against the Prince George's County Jail. Now, Katie, before the break, you heard Ms. Brave Boy talk about her view that they have done a good job, that the county has done a good job in reducing the number of inmates in the jail. She talked about public safety, et cetera. Now, I know there's going to be very different opinions on individual cases, and we just don't have the time to go through the details of individual cases right now. But I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit more about how you respond to her overall take here, that when we're talking about public safety, we're talking about it writ large here, not just for the rights of the people inside the jail, but the rights of the community that surround the jail in the midst of this pandemic.
I agree that we have to care for people's public safety, both inside and outside of the jail. And, you know, as a civil rights attorney, I see that as part of my job, too. And I think that's what our lawsuit is about, because an outbreak in the jail endangers the larger community. And one thing that struck me as Ms. Brayboy was talking was, you know, even when I mentioned a lot of nonviolent people facing nonviolent charges in the jail, she responded just by describing people who were charged with violent crime. But that doesn't explain why this office, you know, for example, you know, is opposing bond for people who are there on trespass charges. It doesn't explain why there's someone in the jail now who's been there for, you know, almost a month on a marijuana charge. That's what we're talking about here. The criminal system is bloated to start. So it is good that the population was reduced. But when we look at who actually needs to be incarcerated to protect public safety, if that's the question that they're asking, you know, even from a relatively conservative risk-averse standpoint, what they're doing by continuing to oppose the release of people who are not charged with anything violent at all and could be on, for example, home detention or, you know, forms of pretrial supervision, I don't see how that advances public safety when they're creating a generator for this virus's spread in a jail that has failed to take basic steps to contain it even to this day.
Well, so on that failure, that alleged failure, at least at one point in time during in the life of this case, which is ongoing here, let me just pull up my notes because we've got a lot of legal documents in front of us. At one point in time, the federal judge overseeing this case said that she could not ignore the jail's, quote, evident disregard for the existence of a clear triple threat: under testing, inadequate treatment and isolation of COVID-19 symptomatic detainees, and no plan for those at high risk of COVID-19 complications. So the court, at least at one point in time, found that there was a problem inside the facility. Has that problem, I mean, the Department of Corrections sent us a lengthy statement, which, by the way, folks could go to onpointradio.org to take a look at, saying, in their view, whatever problem, if it existed, has been taken care of now. It has been improved. There are no issues anymore.
That's not the case. And we've heard that from person after person in the jail. There have been some steps taken. The department is no longer charging for soap. They are no longer charging for sick call. But there are still repeated delays in medical care. And many of the plans that the department submitted to the court to remedy these problems are not actually happening in reality. So, for example, the department said that every day they're asking detainees about whether they have symptoms of COVID. But I have not heard a single person, you know, nor has anyone on our team, after talking to hundreds of detainees, who has said that they've been asked about symptoms. At most, they are asked, do you feel okay, or do you have flu-like symptoms? Many of them learned from us for the first time that headache, nausea, loss of taste and smell were symptoms of COVID. And so there are still massive problems in the jail. It is not equipped to handle new infections. There does not appear to be a plan for new tests. The jail did do one round of universal testing at the end of May, which is a very good thing. It was good that the jail did that. But rewarding the jail for doing the barest minimum when it's failing to take other bare minimum steps that desperately endanger the lives of people, I'm just not willing to congratulate the jail for that. And I don't think that the law supports the idea that there's not still a constitutional violation going there just because they've made certain small improvements, like putting up a poster somewhere. I think, okay, you know, what we're really looking for is changes to access to medical care, real monitoring, real contact tracing, and not using solitary confinement as its blunt instrument in lieu of the steps that are actually recommended by public health professionals.
So that's that 23-hour-a-day lockdown you're talking about.
That's that lockdown. And just to kind of illustrate what that lockdown does, there's ways in which it's actually counterproductive against the spread of COVID. And this is something we've been pointing out since April, and many experts have agreed. So when you only have an hour out of your cell a day, and by the way, you know, at this jail, it could be 1 a.m. Because of the rules of the lockdown, that's your only opportunity to call your family. It's your only chance to call your attorney. It's your only chance to take a shower. And it's your only chance to clean your cell with cleaning products. You can't get the cleaning products when you're locked down. It's your only chance to go outside. So you've got an hour and you've got to choose. Am I going to talk to my kid today? Or do I want to talk to my lawyer about my case? And if I do both, maybe I don't get to take a shower today. That's a situation that these people have been in for months and will continue to be in. And yet basic steps are not being taken. It's just this draconian lockdown that, of course, increases risks in many ways.
So it's interesting because the Department of Corrections, in their statement to us, the Maryland Department of Corrections, pointed to the findings of, we mentioned this a little bit before, a court-appointed health inspector, Dr. Carlos Franco, who talked about that he described the jail as clean and found no evidence of inhumane living conditions. But about what you call that lockdown, that 23 hours a day, in this statement from the DOC, the DOC says Dr. Franco found that the jail had had halted all group activities, staggered recreation time, limited the number of people out of their cells at the same time, all according to CDC guidelines. So they see this as effective infection control in accordance with the Centers for Disease Control.
Well, it's true. They do see it that way, but the Centers for Disease Control actually just issued updated guidance in July specifying that the use of solitary confinement was not recommended for COVID-19. And I also, you know, reading that inspection report and thinking that that's a good report for the jail is really surprising to me. I mean, he said things like, he'd heard reports of the disgusting conditions in isolation cells, but the day he went, they were empty and clean. So the jail moved everyone out of them and it cleaned them before the inspection. That says nothing about whether the jail has a system for maintaining those conditions, whether it's actually maintaining those conditions. A jail can always clean and put up notifications before an inspection. But he found deep problems, like the fact that the nursing staff at the jail tasked with managing this pandemic didn't even know the symptoms of COVID. That strikes me as a very bad problem.
So once again, I just want to remind listeners that we did ask the Maryland Department of Corrections if someone from the DOC could join us in this hour. They declined, but sent us that statement. And again, it's on onpointradio.org. Now, Katie, if you just hang on for a second, in the last several minutes that we have in the program, I want to take a step back here. And Marguerite Leneau joins us now from Washington. She's the supervising attorney at the Office of the Public Defenders in the Prince George's County office. Ms. Leneau, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna.
Okay, so you know what? There's obviously a great deal going on inside this jail and many different perspectives on what's happening. And I wish we could spend more time on the details, but we can't necessarily. I want you to help us understand what this is telling us more broadly about the criminal justice system now. Because I said a little earlier, in the hour that this case is important, not because it's extraordinary, but perhaps because it is not. What do you think about that?
And, you know, that is a great question. And what I first want to share is that I believe Katie mentioned that the jail population currently is back up to 635 detainees. And so if we take a look at that, what I want to stress is that 78% of the population at the Prince George's County Detention Center are African Americans. And the majority of what I see coming through the courtroom since the pandemic, I've spent a lot of time in the bond hearings, which Ms. Braveboy was referring to. The majority of what's coming through the courtroom are young Black males. And the majority of what's being spun and the narrative that is being shared about these young Black males is that they're dangerous. These are all pre-trial, meaning no one has been convicted of anything that has been alleged. So I find it very interesting and telling that when we look at the criminal justice system, we are labeling these individuals as dangerous. We're labeling them as they have committed these offenses, although it's pre-trial, meaning everyone still has that presumption of innocence. However, when we contrast that with what we hear about the lawsuit filed against the Prince George's County Department of Corrections, when referring to that lawsuit, we hear that those are just allegations. And so I think what this tells us about our criminal justice system is that when you are young, when you are Black, when you are a man, when you are alleged to have committed an offense, you're easily labeled as dangerous and needing to be isolated from your community. But when there is a deep dive and look into how you are treated when held, especially during this global pandemic, we still want to look at those as allegations and not having merit. And so I think this just shines a great light on a broader issue. You know, in some of what Katie touched on, I personally, during these hearings, have seen where a 30-year-old father of two charged with car theft, held for 2 months during the pandemic, labeled as dangerous. A 50-year-old grandmother who was charged with domestic affray, held for about 3 weeks because she couldn't afford a $100 bond, again, labeled as dangerous. 24-year-old Black man charged with misdemeanor assault, having no record whatsoever, held without bond, labeled as dangerous. So we really need to take a moment to consider, what is dangerousness? We can't have where it's the same standards or thought process for an individual who's charged with murder as it is for an individual who's charged with simple assault. Those two people cannot be the same level of dangerous just based upon the allegations that are pending. So, you know, I think that this is just a reflection of a larger issue that we have within the criminal justice system, which is fairness and whether or not the criminal justice system really treats individually fairly, or if it just labels you based upon demographics, race, and other factors that we all know.
Mm. Has there also been a slowdown in the processing of cases here? Because, I mean, there was a nationwide lockdown for a while. I, in order to even get to those bond hearings, et cetera, there has to be a functioning court system.
Absolutely. And while there hasn't been a slowdown in arrest, there hasn't been a slowdown in the bond hearings, because the law does require that you have a bond hearing within 24 hours of your arrest, okay, or the next business day. The bond hearing is just a start. So the bond hearing is the determination of whether you will be held prior to your trial date. And the law does say that pretrial detention is the exception. It's not supposed to be the standard, meaning that you really should be a person that it can be clearly and convincingly shown to the judge that this person requires to be held. And what we're seeing, you know, I want to take a step back and say that when this pandemic first happened, Ms. Braveboy is correct, the state's attorney's office worked with our office in order to release individuals that were held. However, that was in March. And what we've seen since March is that although the numbers went down, the number has gone back up. And so the effect of the bond hearings right now and what is happening during the bond hearings is that people are continuing to be held, and their court dates, their trial dates, mm-hmm, those are just starting to happen again, but they're happening very slowly, and they're not happening with the same speed for our incarcerated clients. So we have people who would normally have a trial date within a month of being held, who are going on 3-4 months with not even just not having their trial date occur. They're not given a date. So they're waiting in these conditions with no idea, no date to look forward to, of when they will get their day in court.
In the middle of the pandemic.
In the middle of a pandemic, where again you're locked down for 23 hours, and you know you're making the decision as to when to call, whether to call your attorney, to call your family, to shower, to clean. You know, one of the impacts on our office that has happened in representing, you know, the indigent clients that are held both in the jail and those who are released, is that as an attorney, one of the things that we have always been able to share with the client is what they can expect or when they can expect to go to court. And now we have clients who are calling us and we can't even share that expectation. We can't set a reasonable expectation that you will be able to have your case heard on this day, because we don't know. They're just waiting.
Well, I have to say thank you to everyone who's joined us today, because this is just, it's just one light of a very bright light that we had to continue shining on the criminal justice system. So Marguerite Leneau, supervising attorney for the Office of Public Defenders in Prince George's County, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Katie Chambly Ryan, senior attorney at the Prosecutor Project. Katie, thank you.
Thank you.
We also heard earlier from Aisha Braveboy, the state's attorney in Prince George's County. We've got some documents about this case at our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point.